Again, thank you all for coming. My question for you today is, how do we live with a terminal diagnosis? That's the question. We've all been given a terminal diagnosis. The world's oldest human being at the time, in March of 2015, turned 117 years old. And when asked to ponder the first 117 years of her life, she said, and I quote, "It seemed rather short." 117 years. To put a punctuation mark on her message, and mine, she died a few weeks later. I promise you don't have 117 years in you. Sorry about that. And I also promise that it will seem rather short. I am often accused incorrectly of promoting inaction. Just yesterday in the Washington Post, by the way, I was called a doomist cult hero. A doomist cult hero. And I'm thinking about suing the Washington Post and liar and coward Michael Mann, who authored the piece. Oh, I said that in my out loud voice. Because really, I'm a doomist cult superhero. Yeah. So let's get that right. I jest. I've never promoted inaction. In fact, I think people who are in hospice, I think people who are given a terminal diagnosis that is very short, almost never stop. Almost never in their final weeks say, well, I'm going to die anyway, so I'm just not going to do anything. Sentiment without action is the ruin of the soul, says atheist Edward Abbey. I think that's about right. I'm going to present a little bit of the science. We often hear about the 2-degree target recently promoted by the United Nations, invented by economist William Nordhaus and promoted by the United Nations. But long before all that came along, the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases indicated that 1 degree C was a target. And even before that, United Nations Director of the New York Office of the United Nations Program, Environment Program, Noel Brown, said we have 10 years to solve this whole carbon dioxide problem. That was on June 29th, 1989. I've heard this one before.
Because there's an antenna down here.
Okay. This looks a little funny,
no,
I gotta
say. No, you don't have to do that. Just don't hold it.
We do this whole shtick for free. And this is part of the deal. It's the Guy and Debbie show. I didn't think I was into slapstick. I was criticized for that just earlier today. So, this quote appeared in most newspapers in the United States because it was put out by the Associated Press in late June of 1989. When Noel Brown said, we got 10 years to solve this whole carbon dioxide problem. About 16 months later, the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases says that it's 1 degree Celsius above the 1750 baseline is the absolute upper limit beyond which we will trigger rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage. Two important points there, self-reinforcing feedback loops, rapid, irreversible changes, and we've done that could cause extensive ecosystem damage. The United Nations Environment Program and the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases, they knew what I know, that we're human animals and we need habitat to survive. If habitat goes away through extensive ecosystem damage, then we don't have food. Just like every other animal, we need food and water and air to breathe. In fact, I'm a conservation biologist. The underpinnings of conservation biology are speciation, how a species comes into being and what its precursor species are, extinction, when the last individual of a species dies, and habitat. If I were a realty agent and a conservation biologist, my motto would be habitat, habitat, habitat. That's everything for a species to persist. Climate speaker and writer David Spratt in October 2014 said, it's not one, it was a half. That was the target that we could not cross. We're currently at slightly more than 1.6 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline. 1750 baseline was about 13.5 degrees Celsius, global average temperature. Only 1.5 degrees Celsius higher than an ice age, I'll show a little bit more about that later. So it takes very minor changes in global average temperature to produce profound effects. So we've been warned. We were warned in June of 1989 by Noel Brown, the New York director of the United Nations Environment Program. We were warned then 16 months later by the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases. And for the most part, this was the response. Eyes on the distraction, we went over the cliff. And I'm not pointing any fingers here. This is actually me. People who travel with me are astonished that I don't run into signs or people when I'm looking at my digital device. You know, we're all easily distracted. In addition to abrupt climate change, we have another issue of primary concern, and that's that we are in the midst of the sixth mass extinction on planet Earth. The previous mass extinction events, and a mass extinction event is one in which more than 50% of the species on the planet go extinct. There have been five before, we're in the midst of the sixth. And each of them has been associated with an abrupt rise or abrupt decline in global average temperature. But this particular extinction event is underlain by the most rapid temperature increase in the last 2 billion years, an order of magnitude faster than the great dying of 252.2 million years ago, when more than 90% of the species on the planet went extinct. So this particular abrupt rise in temperature is an order of magnitude faster than the worst of the prior events in the last 2 billion years. And as Gerardo Ceballos, the lead author of the paper that finally pointed out that we were in the midst of the sixth mass extinction about 2 years ago, as he said in an interview at the time, life would take many millions of years to recover, as it has following every mass extinction event, and our species itself would likely disappear early on. He was wrong about that. A United Nations report dated August 2010 estimates 150 to 200 species are being driven to extinction every day. We are not among the species to disappear early on. This has been going on for 7 years now, 150 to 200 species every day. But as a conservation biologist, Ceballos recognizes that we are complex organisms that depend to a very great extent upon a whole bunch of other organisms on the planet. Yeah, sure, we can live on nuclear submarines. Yeah, sure, we can occupy the International Space Station for a while. What do we persist on in those locations? Food grown right here on planet Earth. Without the ability to grow that food, we don't have long. Again, because I'm accused so frequently, many times every day, of promoting inaction, that's not my point. How are you going to live? What are you going to do? You've been given a terminal diagnosis. You don't have long. I'll talk about how long shortly. But as Edward Abbey, the desert anarchist, says, action is the antidote to despair. My response to living with a terminal diagnosis is to pursue radicalism. Most people think radical means extremist, but this mathematical symbol is called a radical because it gets to the root. So if you actually look at the definition of the word radical in your dictionary, you'll see that it means to get to the root. When I was 18 years old delivering the valedictorian address at Highland High School, Craigmont, Idaho, I said, with an enormous amount of hubris, which you might expect for somebody who was 18 years old, anyone can be a conformist, so if you have to be a conformist to reach a goal, just go ahead. So I gave my classmates permission to be strange. So I've been pursuing radicalism for a long time. I have certainly doubled down on that in light of my terminal diagnosis. For many years, I've taught at the university the lies my culture told me, an approach not appreciated at all by the administration. among the lies this culture and every civilization tells us, and they don't really tell us. You know, civilization isn't walking around, this culture isn't walking around coming up to you and saying, hey, you know, humans are superior. Of course not, because that sounds ridiculous when you say it in your out loud voice. Instead, this is what culture whispers in our ear all day, every day. We never say it out loud, but what do we call every other animal on the planet? Collectively, we call them lower animals or lesser animals. What do we call ourselves? Homo sapiens, the wise ape. Insert your own joke here. We assume we can have infinite growth on a finite planet. You say it out loud like that and it's absurd. Obviously that can't happen. And yet, every time you open a checking account and you're told that you're going to earn interest and it's going to be positive interest, you were just sold the infinite growth paradigm. Every time. So we act as if this is the case. More is better, of course. I hear this one all the time. Younger generations will always have it better, and that means they'll always have more than previous generations. That's one of the principles upon which this entire culture sits. We've monetized everything, as with every other version of civilization to precede us. We monetized the air, the water, the food. Yes, even the air. When I was touring New Zealand a few months ago, New Zealand air was being canned, yes, put into cans and taken to China and sold. 85 cents a breath, US. 85 cents. Can you imagine making a can for less than 85 cents? I think probably the mere materials that go into making the can cost a lot more than 85 cents. But if you're desperate for air, desperate times call for desperate measures. So we've actually monetized everything. The United Nations Ecosystem Services Program, which I taught for a few years until I realized it was absurd, puts a price tag on everything. That's the underpinnings of natural resource management. In my home department was the Department of Natural Resources. And so I was teaching the value of songbirds. Talk about human superiority. We get to decide, and the monetary value, by the way, is $5. $5 per songbird, that's according to a paper in the journal Bioscience. That's how much each songbird is worth. And that way we can determine the cost of non-native, non-indigenous species like cats. Because every time a cat, a house cat, goes out and kills a bird, that's $5 right there. I was walking my dog one day, and it's on a wildlife preserve owned by the Nature Conservancy, where I was taking a sabbatical leave from the university. We're walking along, and a quail flew up, and my dog, cold-blooded killer that she was, reached out and grabbed the quail in flight, shook it, and killed it. And my first thought was, that'll be $5. And it wasn't even really a songbird, but it was so inculcated into me that money is everything that matters, and my dog just cost me $5. We monetize everything. The worst of them all, from my perspective, is that this culture tells us to think positive and it'll be okay. If you think negatively, bad things will happen. That's why we're in the midst of abrupt climate change leading to human extinction, is because I thought about it. I have broad shoulders, I can take it. I had negative thoughts one day, and bam, we're going extinct. Way to go, Guy McPherson. Hope, if you actually look up the definition of hope in the dictionary, you're not going to be very impressed. I think you'll be surprised. It really means wishful thinking. It means assuming an outcome over which one has no agency. It's wishing for the best. It's a four-letter word that has another four-letter word on the other side of the I don't know the future coin. We hope for the best, we fear the worst. And we don't act, we just think somebody else is in charge. Finally, this civilization, like all others, is characterized by endemic racism, endemic misogyny, and endemic monetary disparity leading to poverty. And the United States goes on to elect a renowned racist, misogynist, wealthy man, and people are surprised. Funny that. So, these are the assumptions that we live by, that I live by for most of my entire life, that we never question. We just assume them away. And when we actually write them down, we realize they look silly, so we don't write them down. We don't think about them, because thinking about them goes the opposite direction of this one right here. Daniel Dennett was talking about religion when he said there's simply no polite way to tell people they've dedicated their lives to an illusion. And I steal that line and say there's simply no polite way to tell people they've dedicated their lives to an illusion, and in this case, the religion is civilization. In this case, the set of living arrangements that we're all part of is the illusion, underpinned by all those lies. When I recognized that civilization was a life-destroying heat engine that was overheating the planet, I took action. I left active service at the University of Arizona at the age of 49, moved to a 2.7-acre homestead I call the Mud Hut, had built a straw bale house, covered it with solar panels, two solar pumps and a hand pump, and started growing a bunch of food, and built a biochar kiln, and wrote about it in a 2011 book, Walking Away from Empire, learned how to preserve food and cook with the sun, and on and on and on. And I just assumed that because I'm a privileged teacher, a professor, after all, that everybody else would recognize what I recognize, that civilization is a disaster, and they would walk away too. Oh, how naive. There wasn't even a quiz. So, I don't promote inaction. I take action. I don't promote inaction for anybody. But I'm not nearly so judgmental anymore about what action I expect people to take. Because if everybody did this, the house of cards would come down, and because of the absence of global dimming, we'd go extinct even faster. I'll get there in a minute. Tim Garrett is an atmospheric scientist at the University of Utah, and he for years has been writing about civilization, this set of living arrangements, as a heat engine. And he points out that based on the laws of thermodynamics, not the strong suggestions of thermodynamics, but the actual laws of thermodynamics, that it doesn't matter how we power civilization. Solar panels, wind turbines, wave power, whatever you want to use, civilization is still a heat engine. If we have food on the shelves, gas at the filling station, water coming through municipal taps, we got a heat engine going. It's a heat engine that drives to extinction 150 to 200 species every day. It's a heat engine that fouls the air and dirties the water and washes the soil into the ocean. It's a heat engine that does all these horrible things with respect to racism and misogyny and monetary disparity. Civilization is a heat engine. It's such a radical idea, yes, radical, that Garrett's first paper on the topic was written and submitted to 10 different journals and declined by 10 different journals in 2007, finally accepted by Stephen Schneider, the editor of the prestigious journal Climatic Change, and published online in November 2009. Stephen Schneider was dying. There was immediately enormous resistance from the academic community. The publication was pulled from public view, and then two research groups were allowed to write papers pointing out that Tim Garrett must be making this stuff up. No evidence was presented, no counter evidence to counter the idea that civilization is a heat engine. And finally, the paper was published in February 2011 in print form. with those two responses to which Garrett was not allowed to respond. There are politics in science as well. The refereed journal literature represents the most conservative sources you can possibly imagine. There's a double bind. Not only is civilization an omnicidal heat engine, but turning off the switch, turning off the engine of civilization, causes very abrupt heating. The original paper in the journal literature on the topic of global dimming was published by James Hansen and colleagues in December of 2011, and it predicted a global average temperature rise of 1.2 plus or minus 0.2 degrees Celsius, 1.2 plus or minus 0.2 degrees Celsius, within a few days after the sulfates associated with industrial activity fell out of the sky. So not only is civilization a heat engine because of the greenhouse gases produced by industrial activity that trap some of the heat from going back out into space, not only is that going on, but at the same time, industrial activity is producing aerosols, most notably sulfates, from burning low-quality coal, and putting up an umbrella over the planet. According to Hansen and colleagues, that is keeping us cool to the tune of just over 1 degree. According to a later paper, a couple of years later, that's up to about 3 degrees Celsius, the cooling effect of putting aerosols into space. So, it's the catch-22 of civilization. Garrett's work clearly shows, based on thermodynamics, that civilization is a heat engine. And now we know, based on later papers, that if we turn off the heat engine known as civilization, the heat goes up even faster, up to about a 3 degree Celsius global average rise in temperature within a matter of days or weeks, if we could turn off the switch all at one time. A little bit more about the science. Global warming is irreversible without massive geoengineering of the atmosphere's chemistry, according to the most conservative source on the planet, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and their vaunted fifth assessment, officially published in 2014, heavily leaked beginning late in 2013. Okay, so global warming at this point is irreversible. We can't stop it in the absence of massive geoengineering of the atmosphere's chemistry. Oh, wait. That's fantasy technology. According to first the media, paper in Truth Out, and then, lagging only slightly behind, the United States National Academy of Sciences and a European body of similar stature in 2015. So talk about your double bind. Civilization is a heat engine. Turning it off heats the planet even faster. The only way to stop global warming is geoengineering, and geoengineering won't help. This sounds like we got a mess. How bad is the mess? In an essay I wrote August 1st of last year, based on Sam Carana's work from 2 weeks earlier, I added up, taking a very conservative approach, the self-reinforcing feedback loops and other factors that contribute to global average temperature rise, pointed out by Carana. Now, Carana is an interesting case. He was smart enough to do something I didn't do. He's undercover. We don't know who Sam Carana is. He's probably two or three people. He's probably two or three climate scientists working for government agencies. But if he were to write this with his public name, he wouldn't be supported in his job. I'm not saying he would lose his job. I'm saying he would not be supported in his job. Because governments, there are things governments don't want you to know. So, based on his analysis, the temperature within 10 years would rise well beyond the maximum temperature experienced by Earth in the last 2 billion years. You'll notice that over the last 2 billion years, there have been two relatively stable states in terms of temperature. There's Ice Age, about 12 degrees Celsius, and there's hothouse or dinosaur days, that is 22 degrees Celsius. So there's only a 10 degrees Celsius difference between the two common stable states, 18 degrees Fahrenheit difference. That doesn't sound like much, but it's huge in terms of habitat. Karana's analysis indicates we'll be up here, 23.5 degrees Celsius, far higher than anything we've seen in the last 2 billion years. Bear in mind that according to James Hansen, in a legal brief filed a couple of years ago, we've had human beings on the planet only up to 2 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline. The United Nations, based on William Nordhaus, the neoclassical economist's assessment, concludes that 2 degrees is the limit, that that's somehow safe. That's the maximum temperature we've had humans on the planet. What makes you think that's safe? And this is the time during which we've had Homo sapiens on the planet. So we think we're really special. And in fact, we are. Our big brains, our ability to see deep space, our ability to make observations at an incredibly tiny scale. We are truly special organisms. The universe has been here, our universe, approximately 13.8 billion years. And we showed up some 300,000 years ago, and we think it's all about us. The universe has been very patient. I'm sure she's very excited that we finally showed up. According to a compilation in The Guardian put together by Oliver Tickell in August 2008, and this is the headline, on a planet 4C hotter, and this refers to 4C above the 1750 baseline when the global average temperature was 13.5 degrees Celsius. So at 4C hotter than that, or 16.5 degrees global average temperature, all we can prepare for is extinction. Because Oliver Tickell and the scientists he quoted know about habitat. It's not our ability to adapt as individuals to high and low temperatures. We're really quite good at that. We have these clever devices like clothing and fire. You've experienced far more than a 4C temperature change when you came inside from outside. That's not the point. The point is, every other species on the planet, about a trillion species on the planet, every other species on the planet exists within a narrow range of conditions. Soil that is alive with mycorrhizae and bacteria and fungi. Those are all necessary for the plants to live there. They allow the uptake of carbon, the uptake of water. They allow for the breakdown of carbon. They allow all kinds of interesting things to happen, all of which are required for us to live. It's an intricate, delicate web, and we depend upon the whole thing. At some point, you know, these livestock didn't die because they didn't have water. They didn't die because they didn't have air. They died because they didn't have food, because it became dry and warm for an extended period of time. At some point, we're the livestock too. We need habitat, just as every other species does. I took the most conservative approach I could take to Karana's work. Karana points to it about a 10 degree Celsius global average rise in temperature over the course of the next 10 years, starting on July 15th, 2016. So going to mid-2026, he tells us we're headed for a global average temperature well above anything the planet has experienced in the last 2 billion years. I take a very conservative approach to his analysis, come up with a slightly lower number, come up with at least 8.7 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline. Taking an approach that is more conservative than the unbelievably conservative refereed journal literature. I suspect instead we're headed for a global average temperature in the neighborhood of the Great Dying, from 252.2 million years ago in the neighborhood of 23 degrees Celsius, and we will get there an order of magnitude faster than it happened that time. And I don't see any way for the delicate web of life on which we depend to keep up. In fact, based on a paper published in 2013 by John Weens and a colleague, again, conservation biologists, based on that paper, they found that vertebrates are lagging behind the slow rise in global average temperature by a factor of 10,000 times. Vertebrates can't keep up. They're 10,000 times, five orders of magnitude too slow. And that's with gradual temperature change. I want to give as an example of the conservative nature of Carana's approach. Further feedbacks according to him contribute only 0.3 degrees Celsius over the course of the next 10 years. A paper in the Siberian Times in July of last year titled, and you can go check this out yourself, indicates that the permafrost is not nearly as stable as we believed. About 20 seconds into this 32-second clip, a man will plunge the heel of his boot into permafrost, which doesn't look a lot like permafrost. And if you listen closely, you will hear a high-pitched hiss that's pressurized methane and carbon dioxide coming directly out of the ground and into the atmosphere. This is one of more than five dozen self-reinforcing feedback loops not accounted for by Carana and contributing only 0.3 degrees Celsius global average temperature rise in the next decade. I just want to indicate how conservative this approach is. This is permafrost. It's not supposed to do that. If you didn't hear that high-pitched hiss the second time the boot heel went into the ground, I would encourage you to go to the SiberianTimes.com and listen more closely. It's really quite impressive. Because of the lies the culture tells us, we think we can just keep living the same way and the children will adapt. After all, it's always been better for them before, and we have this amazing technology. And we do. There's no question. You can check everything I'm telling you today in a matter of minutes on a digital device you can carry in your pocket. You can find out that everything I've said is based on the work of others and is published and is freely accessible to anybody. My analysis indicates we're headed for a temperature right here, slightly above the most common stable state Earth has experienced, and that we're headed there now in about 9 years. Again, we've had humans and therefore habitat for humans up to this temperature, and conservatively I'd say we might have humans there taking the 4C approach, maybe even to there. How would we know? We haven't gone extinct yet. We don't know the temperature at which humans go extinct. This time, 252.2 million years ago, almost all complex life on the planet, almost all multicellular life on the planet went extinct. But, as I indicated, we're pretty special. We don't know. I doubt we make it through that bottleneck. If instead of taking an additive approach, instead of just adding up the individual contributions to temperature rise, methane, reduction in albedo in the Arctic, carbon dioxide and the 10-year lag between emissions and maximum heating, and so on, if instead of adding those up, which takes us to approximately this temperature right here, we could instead fed an exponential curve to the data And when Sam Corana does that, he indicates we're headed for 10 degrees warmer, 23.5 degrees Celsius global average temperature in 4 years. And lest you think that's absurd, bear in mind that it was a similar analysis conducted in 2012 that led to a temperature rise, a conclusion of a temperature rise of 4C above baseline in 2030. And that number now seems incredibly conservative. 4C by 2030. That sounds ridiculously low. And it was based on a similar sort of approach, projecting into the exponential future. So it could be that the temperature rises to a really high level within 4 years. On the other hand, if we take a statement from Shakova and colleagues, Natalia Shakova and three colleagues at the European Geophysical Union meetings late in 2008, when they wrote in the abstract and then she presented the information, much like I'm presenting this today, quote, release of up to 50 gigatons of hydrate, that's methane hydrate, is highly possible for abrupt release at any time. She concludes, the research team concludes, that would add 1.3 degrees Celsius to the global average temperature. That would take us well beyond the point at which humans have persisted on this planet in the past and almost certainly collapse industrial civilization because of the inability to grow grains at scale. The attendant increase in temperature when industrial civilization collapses and stops putting the umbrella up into the air from the aerosol effect or the sulfates or the global dimming is at another approximately 3, and then bam, by maybe the middle of next year we're at 6C above the 1750 baseline. This assumes two things: that either we have an ice-free Arctic as predicted in an analysis done by the U.S. Naval Postgraduate College to occur in 2016, plus or minus 3 years. It looks like that's going to happen this year, but of course we don't know for sure. If it does, then I don't see any way to avoid this methane bomb from going off. So I'm making a couple of assumptions here. I'm a little surprised, actually, the methane bomb hasn't gone off already. I mean, Shakova and colleagues did not conclude that this would happen only with an ice-free Arctic. This was 2008. We weren't really all that close to an ice-free Arctic at that time. But if we have an ice-free Arctic this summer or next or the next, I don't see any way to keep a lid on that enormous burst of methane that is already spewing out of the relatively shallow seafloor of the Arctic Ocean. So that could happen by the middle of 2018 because of the burst of methane this summer in light of an ice-free Arctic, and then the collapse of crop production as a result, and the inability to store and transport grains all over the planet. So 6C seems like it's a pretty dangerous number to me by the middle of next year. It could be that civilization itself collapses for any number of other reasons. You know, it could be we have a global financial crisis such as the one that occurred in 2008, and as a consequence that contributes to a domino effect that causes all of civilization to collapse. That was the premise of Tom Hartmann's book, which came out in 2013, called The Crash of 2016. And he predicted the crash of 2016 in this book, written in 2013, published in 2013. And I thought when it came out, that's incredibly conservative. There's no way this set of living arrangements holds together until 2016. And yet here we are, and it has. Will it hold together in the face of an ice-free Arctic? Will it hold together in light of the very abrupt temperature rise that has occurred in the last few years, therefore already threatening grain production? Will it hold together with the kind of political infighting and backbiting that is going on right now? Well, I don't know. It could be that by this September, and all the big crashes since 1929 have occurred in September, except one, Enron, occurred October 1st. So it could be that this September the house of cards comes down. That's what Tom Hartmann was predicting with his very conservative analysis in 2013. I'm amazed we made it this far. Nobody's in control. The house of cards could come down any time. I'm not making a prediction here, although Tom Hartmann was. I wouldn't say he's wrong. I'd say he was ahead of his time on this and many other issues. So that could be. And that would take us to nearly 5 degrees Celsius, up to about 5 degrees Celsius above the 1750 baseline by October of this year. I'm not saying this will happen. I'm saying it could happen. And I have good news. I have a happy ending. How can I not? It's Hollywood land. You know, we're here in the United States. How could I let you down with an unhappy ending? Here's the message. Someday we all die. Oh, wait. That didn't sound that great when I said it out loud like that. On all the other days, we don't. There, that sounds a lot better, doesn't it? I'm sure most of you are familiar with the word, the acronym YOLO. You only live once. It's actually wrong. It's wrong. I'm here to correct that for you. You're welcome. It's YODO. You only die once. You live every day. If you take that choice, you live every day, you live every moment. If you choose, you only die once. People ask me all the time, what the hell? They're usually not that nice, to be fair. People ask me all the time, what are you doing? If this is unstoppable, if there's nothing that can be done, if this high temperature rise is locked in and we're headed for extinction, why are you telling people? What kind of jerk are you? I'm the kind of jerk that your medical doctor is when your medical doctor knows you have 6 weeks to live and he tells you. In fact, if your medical doctor knows that with great certainty, with 99% certainty, based on all the evidence and all the cases in the past, that you're not going to live 6 weeks, and he or she doesn't tell you that, there's a word for that, isn't there? It's malpractice. A lot of people who are writing and speaking about climate science are exhibiting malpractice. I'm here to set you free, because the truth will set you free. Of course, it'll really piss you off first. Let me tell you the response to the message that you get to live every day and that you have a terminal diagnosis. The response from 25-year-old Serena Raphael, living in Western Australia, is to tell me that I completely liberated her soul, that I freed her to live outside of the box, outside of the jail cell into which she was born. And I get this from millennials all the time. Millennials tell me all the time that they know they've been lied to, and they're getting the whole thing dumped on them, and it's incredibly unfair, that their college instructors tell them, I'm a baby boomer and I really screwed it up and I'm sorry about that, you're gonna have to fix it. Really? That's the best we can do? I enjoyed enormous privilege and enormous wealth. Thank you very much, future generations. Oh, there won't be any. You're gonna have to fix it. How absurd. I have several messages that fall under the category of taking action. And the primary three of them I list on this slide. First of all, remain calm. Nothing is under control. For some people, what I really should say is calm down, because some people are not calm yet. So remaining calm is something of an overstatement. If you're calm, or once you get to become calm, I recommend you stay there. This is not your fault. You were born into captivity just like the rest of us. You were born into the jail cell that is the set of living arrangements. You just did what everybody did. You did what the culture expected of you. You went to high school and then you went to college and then you got married and you had 2.5 children and you worked 40 years until you had enough money that you could retire. And then you started enjoying life. You were just playing the game. Those are the cards you were dealt. It all seems kind of silly now. In addition, I recommend the pursuit of excellence. I'm not going to define that for you. You all have dictionaries. I don't even know what it means for you. I barely know what it means for me. And the pursuit of love, I don't need to define that either, I don't think. What I'm saying here is do what you love and do it well. There is one caveat. You get to control or at least influence to a limited extent the lives of the people around you, the people you interact with every day. You can be a jerk. I've done it myself. I'm not too proud of it, but I recognize when it happens in retrospect. You don't have to do that. Some things are under your control, including to a limited extent, the emotions of the people you share your time with. So you can call people names or you can be compassionate. That's a choice you get to make. There are other things we can do. For example, your dog is happier than you because when you take your dog on a walk in a park and there are four trees and the sun, your dog sees, believe it or not, four trees and a sun. And you and me have cluttering up in our heads all these things from the past and all these things from the future over which we have absolutely no control, and we don't even see the four trees and the sun, and we barely know there's a dog tugging at the leash. We've all been there. So one thing we might want to do is become more fully present when you're in a beautiful place. Smell the flowers. Another thing we can do is to stop using the expectations of others as the bars to reinforce the cage into which we were born. You don't have to have 2.5 children. You don't have to go to school. You don't have to go to more school. You don't have to get $100,000 of student debt just to pursue a job that isn't going to be out there when you're done. You don't have to do those things. There are other ways to live beyond the dominant paradigm. We assume there's one way to live. There's one way to live. How could that be? Before the first civilization showed up a few thousand years ago, there were lots of different ways to live, probably thousands of different ways to live. There were hunter-gatherers, and there were gatherers, and there were hunters, and there were Apaches raiding other people and killing them for their food. There's all kinds of different ways to live. Now there's just this one thing. And if you live just a little bit outside of that narrow envelope, you get these looks. What is that guy doing? He's not acting like the rest of us. I'm not promoting inaction. There's more things you can do. You can read a little. All of the science I've presented today is found in this one essay. If you want to pursue this further, if you've come to grips with near-term human extinction, you want to talk about it, what that means, and how you find your purpose and your passion, and what you actually want to do with your life. I'm one of the people who created a workshop that's just for you. So people ask me all the time, yeah, but all right, that all sounds great in theory. That's 9 different things I could be doing. Or maybe you just want to be a human being instead of a human doing, and just immerse yourself in the natural world. And enjoy it and appreciate it and not actually do anything. It's all this doing that got us into this damn mess. But you might want to do, and you know, not doing is doing something too. People ask me all the time, yeah, but what about you? What are you doing, Mr. Holier Than Thou, standing up in the church telling the people in the pews how they should live? Making recommendations? What about you? What are you doing? It's weird. This is only the second stop on the speaking tour, and it's been a church both times. And it's the first 2 times I've been in a church in a really long time. So what am I doing? I'm trying to model behavior that I promote as decent behavior. I'm trying to remain calm. I'm trying to pursue life in a rational way, in a rational manner, based upon reason. I'm trying to pursue my version of excellence, which is in part to remind people that something they've known since they were 11, that they're going to die too, and that it will seem rather short. And I'm doing what I love in a place I love. I'm trying to be present with enormous gratitude for what I've had. I've lived 57 years on the planet. 57 years, that's a long time. How'd you get so much gray hair in only 57 years? Practice, practice, practice. And I had all those graduate students too. I'm discussing the unthinkable with anybody who comes along. Pity the poor woman who sits next to me in the window seat on the plane. I'm in the aisle seat, she's trapped in there. And she says something ridiculous to start the conversation. She almost always starts it. I don't go there. No. She says, "Hi." If that doesn't scream near-term human extinction, I don't know what does. So once she opens the can of worms, I'm going to have the conversation with her. Who am I to deny her that? I live on a homestead in Belize with 10 adults, I think, at present, and a couple of roughly teenage kids. And we actually discuss the unthinkable. Currently, we're researching symptoms and treatments of the leading causes of human mortality in the area, which I suspect in the very near term will be exceeding physiological tolerance for heat, exceeding the wet bulb temperature beyond which humans are able to cool themselves. Even with a fan pointed at you, you can't dump heat fast enough if it's 95 degrees and 100% humidity or some combination of higher temperature and lower humidity. You can't keep up. So the people I share the world with on these 57 acres in the Central American country of Belize had better know what the symptoms are of exceeding lethal wet bulb temperature so that we can take action. Or if we're unable to take action, to know when we're dying. Hunger is the other, I suspect, the other leading cause of mortality for people there. That's not going to happen as long as we have grocery stores. It's not going to happen as long as we can grow food. But we're headed for a very near term, very abrupt rise in temperature that will exceed our capacity to do that. How do we want to act with each other when the unthinkable happens, when we don't have food, when people cannot dump heat fast enough, so their skin is cold and clammy? We want to be able to recognize it. We want to act with compassion. We want to help people on their way out the door. We discuss the unthinkable, including our own early exit. I'm not encouraging suicide, and I'm not judgmental against people who choose that route. In this country, it's actually fairly easy. There are entire organizations that will help you buy the helium tank and the mask and show you just how to use it so you can take your early exit in a clean manner with apparently little pain. I haven't tried it myself, despite the recommendations of some of my critics. I think it's worth having the conversation. We're also building things, and this sort of drives people crazy. Why are you building this nice quadplex that is designed to host visitors? Why are you doing that if you think the end is nigh? And I do think the end is nigh, and I still floss and brush my teeth. I do think the end is nigh, and I'm still taking action that I think is right action. So we're building these structures. So, for example, my partner, if her three adult children decide that when the nuclear power facilities right outside of Brooklyn where they live melt down, they might want to have a different place to live in their final days or weeks or months. In addition to the outcome, to which I'm not particularly attached, the outcome of having more space for more people, in addition to that, by building buildings, we are building community. Aristotle defined friendship as a relationship between people who are working together on a project for the common good. Friends are not merely drinking buddies. The people I share these 57 acres with are working together on a project for the common good. You could do worse. I'll stop there, and I'd be happy, ecstatic, really, if somebody else besides me would talk for a while, maybe even ask a question or two. So, why do I think the majority of climate scientists are not presenting the evidence? I think that's the question. Why do I think they're wrong? I think they're not wrong. I think they are unwilling to present the evidence that is before us. Unwilling or unable. There are a few reasons for that. Almost zero climate scientists have any background in ecology or conservation biology. Essentially none. They're almost all physicists and atmospheric scientists. Those are the degrees James Hansen has, for example. They also are involved in a very conservative endeavor, a very conservative approach. Academic science is very conservative. Publishing the referee journal literature is an incredibly conservative process. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change begins with the referee journal articles. For example, in the vaunted fifth assessment of the IPCC, the word methane was mentioned exactly twice, and that was in a single table. So methane is suggested to be not particularly important, and yet the field research conducted by people actually out in the field suggests otherwise. And here I'm thinking about Shakova and colleagues and Peter Wadhams, director of the Ocean Physics Program at Cambridge for many years, and so on. So I think there's an unwillingness to take on the task of an integrative approach. You're certainly not encouraged to do that in academia. I spent a long time there in my silo, and trying to break out of the silo and interact with other people from other departments is painfully difficult. So I don't think all climate scientists are cowards and liars. I think that they are just unable or unwilling to take a more comprehensive approach and to add up or multiply together the self-reinforcing feedback loops and other contributors to global average temperature rise. And you're right. I put out a prediction. I predict that there won't be a human being on the planet 9 years from today. I'm open for business and very, very wishful about being wrong. I don't even want to die. I certainly don't want our entire species to go extinct. I'm not doing this for money or power or position. I'm not sounding the alarm because it generates a lot of money for me. I don't want this to happen just like nobody else wants it to happen either. But I can add up a few numbers and connect a few dots. I'm in a position where I'm able to do that because I haven't earned a paycheck for more than 8 years. My paycheck does not depend upon what I say because I don't have a paycheck. It's really a liberating position. It's a little awkward sometimes, like, you know, around dinner.
I'm interested in your work on symptoms. Talk about what you expect to release. Here in Chicago, what do we have? 5 to 8 million people in the metro area. Would you expect similar kind of symptoms here around heat and food, or would you expect us to see other things?
I suspect the ability to distribute grains will cause civilization to meet its demise in the not-too-distant future, in light of an ice-free Arctic and the massive temperature rise associated with methane release. So whether that happens this September or next September, or the September after that, I suspect civilization will go away and that it will really be quite abrupt. So I suspect most people in cities, especially large cities, will meet their demise when the water stops coming through the taps and they have the conversation around the dinner table. Well, this has happened before. In a few hours, surely it'll come back on, and 4 days later, almost nobody's left alive because of dehydration, because of thirst. That's a guess. That's a speculation at this point. We don't know. I don't know your expiration date. I don't know the day civilization collapses. I don't know the day the trucks stop running and bringing food to the grocery stores. But I do know that in mega cities like this one, if you don't have municipal systems operating at top speed, at high levels of efficiency, then you don't have the services that you've come to depend upon. And that includes water coming through the taps.
I'd say the one thing we can do, knowing this information is true, is to share more. We can share books and newspapers. We can share housing. We can share gardening and farming, and we can share ideas, but we can also share something that we don't actually use a lot, which is we-dias instead of ideas. In other words, our imaginations that are more sharing-based instead of greed-based. I think you've sparked a lot of great we-dias this evening, and I just wanted to commend you for that.
Well, thank you, and that brings up a good point. For the most part, this is a very... that there is encouragement to hoard in this culture. And so we look at the five people in the world who have as much wealth as half of the people in the world, and that's where we're at now. Like 4 years ago, it was 40 people, and then it was 20, and then it was 8, and now it's 5 people in the world who have as much wealth as half of the people on the planet. And those 5 are hoarders. They're not sharing. They're hoarding. And we get our inspiration from those folks, right? We're temporarily embarrassed millionaires, as John Steinbeck pointed out. And so we take our cues from the 1% who are acting in the most horrific of manners. And so, absolutely, we can share more. Not everybody on the block needs a lawnmower. You know, actually, nobody on the block needs a lawnmower, but it's a whole nother issue. Thank you for your comment.
I've had many instances in which the papers do not actually say what you claim they do. For instance, the umbrella effect of sulfate aerosols is about a tenth of the number that you put up there, and you have several climate sensitivities that were calculated over about 100 years that you're saying apply on the scale of a decade. What's your response?
According to a paper in Journal of Geophysical Research Atmospheres, published the 20th of May, 2013, the absence of global dimming will produce up to about a 3 degrees Celsius temperature rise. I didn't make that up. It's actually printed in the abstract of the paper, which is available to anybody. Climate sensitivity was at one time believed to be quite low. And we now know that climate sensitivity is very high. A minor example is 9/11. On September 14th, 2001, a researcher went out and thought, well, it's been 3 days since commercial aircraft were grounded in the United States. I wonder if there's a measurable effect. And sure enough, there was. 3 days later, there was a significant difference in the global average temperature signature of Earth, presumably as a result of the great reduction in commercial air flights in the United States. That's all. We didn't stop burning coal. We're still driving around. Commercial aircraft were flying in other countries. Climate sensitivity is very, very high. So the response to those two questions is, this paper says otherwise to the first question, and the evidence says otherwise to a very great extent for the second question.
A number of climate scientists have been threatened. Peter Robinson's reported threats. Michael Mann was threatened. He's written about his family having been threatened for his, at a certain point in time, standing up with a hockey stick proposition. And so we have this history of climate scientists being actually threatened, or families being threatened. And I think that's a pretty salient feature of what's going on with this debate. For example, Guy, you could be wrong about the dynamics that you're laying out here today, and the time frame, and that would be wonderful news. You would be very happy if you were wrong. But on the other hand, you may be right about the dynamics, and it seems like a lot of climate scientists agree with you pretty much. They may say we have till 2050, or maybe we have until 2100 to come up with solutions. But they agree with you on the dynamics. I think there needs to be a buffer zone for people to be able to stand up and discuss these issues. I heard Peter Wadhams in an interview with Tom Hartman basically say that it was necessary to have described it as a Manhattan Project in order to cool the planet. And he said that would take tremendous amounts of money, which would have to come out of military budgets.
Yeah, well, you bring up a lot of things. Wadhams proposes geoengineering to cool the planet. Wadhams is one of several people who has been forced to pursue a different agenda, presumably because of the things he's been saying. Camille Parmesan, conservation biologist at the University of Texas in Austin, was heavily censored, so she moved to London. Jason Box, glaciologist at Ohio State University, was heavily censored, so he went to Denmark. I was harassed at the University of Arizona, and so I left of my own volition before either of those two individuals left. Peter Wadhams, although he will never say it in public, has admitted that he was forced into retirement, something that hasn't happened with colleagues of similar stature who are still bringing in grant money, as he is, from Cambridge, and now he teaches someplace else. Another example, Shakova and three colleagues published this information at the European Geophysical Union meeting. And a few years later, Shakova, in an interview, said, "We never stated a 50-gigaton burst of methane was possible in near or distant future. We never stated." She didn't retract the statement. She could have gone to her colleagues, and they could have retracted the statement. They could have said, "It seems we were wrong about that. We're now siding with modelers such as Gavin Schmidt and David Archer and agreeing that the models are right, that field observations are just dead wrong, and that there will never be a significant release of methane." She could have said that, but no, she said, "We never stated this." And they did state this. They absolutely did. She didn't retract. She lied. Why? Why do we have this kind of behavior amongst climate scientists? I suspect it has a lot to do with people not being discouraged to supply all of the evidence. I don't think people would be supported in their positions if they said the kinds of things that I say. I'm not saying they would lose their jobs. I'm saying they would not be supported in their jobs. That's very important. You know the importance of being supported in your work. So, I think there's a lot going on here. That's a great question. Thank you.
You mentioned something about it. A day was come up. It was a later day than yours. Something about this, some contact from the CIA about when the nuclear plants were going to melt down. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah. And I don't talk about this much anymore because There's a guy who claims to be an NSA contracted spy who's assigned to me, who was in my classroom in 2005. And he says that, according to a report to be released later this year by the Jason Group in the Pentagon, the Earth will lose its atmosphere because of ionizing radiation stripping off the atmosphere and going to space. So Earth will resemble Mars in about 2054. Not Venus, but Mars. But, you know, he claims to be an NSA contracted spy, and if he is a spy, we know he's lying, because that's what spies do. And if he's not a spy, then he's lying about being a spy. So, I don't know what's going on here, but I'm not presenting that information anymore, because I don't think it helps, because it's really difficult to track down the validity of what he's saying. Now, if the Jason Group does come out with a report later this year and it is made public and it says what he says it's going to say, then that's something. And that lends credibility to what he's saying. But if they don't ever do that, then, well, he's lying. So, yeah, you heard correctly. And I just don't know what to make of it anymore.
Did
the Fukushima and the effect of the nuclear power plants when industrial civilization collapses. I just was wondering if you could get into the details for the audience about Fukushima and what would happen with the nuclear power plants around the world.
Yeah, nuclear power facilities around the world require grid-tied power. They require to be tied to the grid.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah. Nuclear. Nuclear power facilities must be tied to the grid to maintain continuous operation. And when the grid fails, as it did at Fukushima, the backup generators kick in and they run on diesel or gasoline, and so they have a finite life. As it turns out at Fukushima, somebody hadn't been paying attention, so they were out of gasoline and diesel far more quickly than they were supposed to be. They were supposed to have a 2-week supply. But regardless, when civilization fails, people are not going to go to their jobs at the nuclear power facility. Money is not worth anything. Even first responders don't respond after a few days. They return home to protect their own families. So in the face of a dire catastrophe, nobody is going to be watching the store. According to the latest ex-head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of the United States, a guy named Jasko, it takes 50 or 60 years to decommission a single nuclear power plant once the money is available to start shutting it down. That's to safely decommission. And we aren't doing that. There's more than 440 nuclear facilities around the world, and we aren't working to shut down, to safely decommission a significant number of them. And until we do, 5 stories above ground at Fukushima and approximately 100 other GE similar technology nuclear facilities, similar to Fukushima, have cooling ponds 5 stories above ground that constantly require water circulating through them to cool the, quote, spent fuel rods. And if that water isn't constantly circulating, it evaporates off, and then you have fuel rods exposed to the atmosphere and they blow up and produce the kinds of fires this planet has never seen. Then we've got ionizing radiation spewing all over the globe. A disadvantage is that the lethal mutations that result from ionizing radiation are transmitted through multiple generations. So, around Chernobyl, and that big event happened, what, 1987, I believe it was? No, Chernobyl. I think that happened in 1987, and now it's a veritable wildlife paradise. There are wolves everywhere. It looks great, but all of those wolves are exhibiting lethal mutations. And it won't take very many generations before there are no wolves. The horrors associated with multi-generational lethal mutations is far worse than abrupt climate change because it persists for so long. So you might have children, and you have not been significantly affected by Fukushima or Chernobyl. But what about in the future? What about your children and their children and the lethal mutations that would take hold because of ionizing radiation affecting everything? The air you breathe, the water you drink. It's everywhere already. And we're not being told nearly enough about that with respect to Fukushima or Chernobyl or Three Mile Island, for that matter. Strike 3. Aren't we done with nuclear facilities yet? Apparently not.
Contentious political system right now. When people come up and start talking about Trump, whatever, what do you tell them? Everybody's talking about politics. What do you say with your perspective?
I'm an anarchist. That doesn't mean what you think it means. You know, there's so many words in this culture that we've been confused about, like radical. Radical doesn't mean extremist, it means to get to the root. Anarchists take responsibility for themselves and for their neighbors. Chaos is the absence of rules. Anarchism is the absence of rulers. It means taking responsibility for yourself, not throwing Molotov cocktails into every building. So as an anarchist, I believe in taking responsibility for myself, not capitulating to the nanny state. This is why I've lived off-grid for the last decade, approximately. So politics, you know, the twin cheeks of the corporate ass representing the blue and the red, is just a show, as far as I'm concerned. It's a great show sometimes. It's hilarious. But I tend to view the world through a lens inspired by Camus, a lens of absurdity. And the political sideshow going on in the United States is just the latest example. But if you've been paying attention, you know that it's been like this for a long time. There's been this distracting sideshow that I couldn't care less about. I mean, the government has great impact on my life, mostly with respect to taking money and influencing my ability to harvest rainwater and, you know, other really important things like that. But to the maximum extent possible, I try to ignore the government. And that's one of the reasons I live where I do, because the Central American country of Belize is so poor and the government is so poorly structured that the government really has very little opportunity to interfere with my daily life. Unlike in the United States, where the government can interfere with your daily life any day, any time. So, it's just a show. As Bill Hicks said, and George Carlin, it's just a show. I don't get too worked up about the absurdities I see. It's just more gallows humor on our way out the door. Well, I always look for the opportunity to speak the unspeakable, of course.
I've observed guys since yesterday, and he'll bring it up to anybody. The poor guys in the U.S. Cellular store yesterday down in Earful, and they were totally on board with this. It was interesting.
That's because they're millennials.
Yeah.
So I take my dying phone into the T-Mobile store, and I explain to them that we're all going to die, and they're wondering what that has to do with the phone. Well, the phone's dying too. Look, it's a metaphor. These connections are everywhere. They took it well.
What part of the world besides the major cities do you think is going to be that people are going to be?
Yeah, what areas are going to be impacted first and worst as a result of abrupt heating? Well, there have been 5 previous mass extinctions on planet Earth. We're in the midst of the 6th. 2 of the previous ones were heating events. 3 of them were cooling events. Abrupt heating, abrupt cooling. The worst of the extinction events occur with heating. We're in the midst of the 3rd big heating event, and the worst of them by far. And during those abrupt increases in temperature events, like the Great Dying, there's life at the poles. Life goes away first at the equator. During cooling events, it's the opposite. During ice ages, there's life at the near the equator and not so much at the poles. So I currently live at about 17 degrees north latitude. I moved from 34 degrees north latitude just to get, you know, that much closer to the equator so that I could go first. I'm trying to set an example here. So near the equator is the worst place to be. The northern hemisphere is worse than the southern hemisphere because the southern hemisphere has a whole bunch of water and a really large body of ice that is not going to disappear this year or next. Antarctica. And it provides enormous cooling for the Southern Ocean and therefore for Tasmania, the southern island state of Australia, and for New Zealand. So when I was touring New Zealand last November and December, occasionally I would point out that there's a reason all these incredibly wealthy people like James Cameron are buying up land in New Zealand. And my host, Kevin Hester, would come running up to the front of the room and say, "Don't listen to him, don't listen to him. You don't want to move here." Steve Wozniak, one of the 3 founders of Apple Computer and the guy who single-handedly built the Apple I and Apple II computers, contacted me in December of 2012 and said, "Okay, I got this, you're right. I think there's going to be habitat for humans much longer in the southern hemisphere than the northern hemisphere, so I'm going to move to the southern hemisphere in a couple of years. And sure enough, 2 years later, he moved to Tasmania, the southern island state of Australia. And in those early days, I was thinking and even saying out loud that I thought there would be a pretty big difference between the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere. I thought we would lose habitat way faster, maybe even 10 or 15 years faster in the northern hemisphere than in the southern hemisphere, because there's all the nuclear power facilities in the northern hemisphere. There's only 4 in the southern hemisphere. There's all the continental landmass in the northern hemisphere. That's where almost all the landmass for the whole planet is in the northern hemisphere. There's about a third of Africa, all of South America, and all of Australia and New Zealand in the southern hemisphere. That's it. But North America, Asia, Europe are in the northern hemisphere. We know that the interior of large continents heats up at least twice as fast as the global average. So you don't want to be in the center of a large continent in the northern hemisphere. So for a while, I thought there's a big difference, maybe 10 or 15 years for habitat for humans in the southern hemisphere as opposed to the northern hemisphere. Well, now I think it might be 10 or 15 days. So poor Steve Wozniak moved to the southern hemisphere with his fourth wife, Janet, because of something that I said a long time ago, and now he won't speak to me anymore. I don't think it makes a huge difference. Now when people ask me where they should go, as if should has any meaning to me at all, I ask them what their goals are, and for most people it's to live a long time. And then I tell them we can rule that out right away, that it will seem rather short. And then I say, well, I wouldn't recommend a geographical change. I would recommend an anatomical change. I would recommend that you go inside yourself, figure out who the hell you are and what it is you're trying to get out of this life, and more importantly, what you're trying to put into this life. I think those are the important issues. Not how many days you have left, but how you live them. That's the measure of your integrity. That's the measure of your character, is how you provide service to the living planet, to the other humans around you. We don't have long. Pursue excellence. Pursue what you love. Do it well. And hope and pray and wish, just like I am, and I'm an atheist, that I have put together the evidence in a way that is just flat wrong. Just hope and pray and wish that all these climate scientists published on all these referee journal literatures are way too liberal. Somebody suggested today that people might suspect me of being in the employee of the Koch brothers or maybe ExxonMobil. Because my message is to do what you love and to do it well, to pursue excellence, to pursue love, to remain calm, nothing is under control. And there's a whole bunch of people out there who are telling you we need to take urgent action. Now, I don't know what the hell that urgent action is. For a while, I thought it was eliminating civilization, the omnicidal heat engine. Now we know that that leads to human extinction even faster. So what is it? Is it maintaining the omnicidal heat engine? Which part of civilization do you want to keep going? Is it working on the nuclear power facilities so we can continue to boil our water? I don't know what that action is. So for me, and my recommendation for you, is to make it local. Make it about you and the people you spend your days with. That's all we've ever had anyway. All we've ever had is right now with the ones we're with. You'd think that was impossible for people to get. There's no escape. You were born into a jail cell known as civilization, and there's no escape. Be the best human being you can be. Do what you love. Do it well. So the question is, she loves The Hitchhiker's Guide, and I read 2 of the sequels. I really like them, too. And so am I willing to share anything that I think is important to carry with me or to recommend to you to read? How I got here was in my early 30s, starting to read philosophy, and ultimately that led me to reading a lot of ancient philosophy. So I spent a lot of time with Schopenhauer and Nietzsche, and then went back to the original writings of Plato, most notably. And so that's been very influential for me, is developing my own sense of personal philosophy. Almost every week, somebody sends me a book. Typically, they're fix-it books for a predicament that, as nearly as I can tell, is unfixable. And it's kind of a pain in the ass because I have to go into the post office and it's 30 minutes drive away, so I only go there once a month or so. And I get anything that comes in a package that won't fit in a little tiny postal box, the postal people force me to open right there in front of them and then pay a tax on whatever it is. So I'm paying tax on all these books I'm not going to read. I'm very comfortable with my own personal philosophy. It took me a decade to figure out who I was. And I'm not going to be changed by your book that tells me how to fix something. I'm not. So I'm going to read the book flaps, maybe a chapter. That's about as far as I can get in any books that are telling me how to fix things or fix myself anymore. So I recommend going back to the ancient documents, going back to Plato and his description of Socrates. There's a lot there to read and a lot there to learn from. But don't take it as the gospel. The question is, what's the simple method for starting the conversation about abrupt climate change? Because Dave, my driver for most of the last couple of days, has been uniformly unsuccessful in engaging people with the conversation nobody wants to have. And as I indicated, I use kind of the brute force approach, you know, with the person who happens to be stuck next to me on the airline. And that isn't working particularly well. I don't know what works. You know, now I'm not so much interested in sharing the information unless somebody really exhibits a desire to know. No, really, I believe that, despite what Debbie told you about what happened at the T-Mobile store. Those people brought it up. They brought it upon themselves. They asked me what I was here for. So they just threw the door wide open, and I barely squeezed through it. So I don't know what works. And, you know, some people find it very frustrating when they try to have conversations about, for example, the lies my culture tells me. There's a whole bunch of things, a whole bunch of topics that we just don't talk about that are just absolutely taboo. We don't talk about anything that really matters, right? Money, sex, bodily functions, grief, dying. Those are all off the table. We can't talk about any of those things. Why is that? So I'm all into breaking those taboos, and it's awkward sometimes.
Today Trump was in Paris. Someone asked him whether he had changed his thoughts on the Paris Climate Accords, and at this point, does it matter what he does?
I don't think it matters much, and I don't think he's as in charge as most people seem to think he is. For example, the Paris Accords. Remember, the ideal would have been to hold the global average temperature at 1.5 degrees below baseline, the 1750 baseline. That was the goal. That was the original goal, 1.5 degrees. And worst case scenario is to hold it at 2. Okay. So 4 months later, we were at 1.6. Whoops. That didn't pan out. And there is no way to hold it below 2. It is impossible. We can collapse industrial civilization, and that causes it to heat up magnificently, or we can keep the omnicidal heat engine going, and that will continue to heat the planet. Pick your poison, it's poison. Civilization is a heat engine. Turning the engine off heats it up faster. It's a classic catch-22. But we actually know these things based on abundant evidence at this point. That doesn't mean it's going to be Trump's fault that a whole bunch of people are going to die. I don't think he even wanted to win. I think he was as surprised that it says anybody else. And then he landed in this seat and he's like, it's like the Robert Redford character in the movie The Candidate, you know, who ran this brilliant campaign and had no idea what to do next. So they're sitting around in the room after the election, after he wins the election, and he says, now what do we do? No idea. You know, there's such a large rise in temperature locked in within the next few years that it doesn't really matter that Trump gets blamed for a whole bunch of people's death, because he inherited this mess. I almost feel sorry for him.
We hear a lot about going to an inhospitable planet such as Mars and maintaining life there. Now, is anyone working on maybe adapting those kinds of technology to Earth as it becomes more inhospitable?
Yeah, and you know, there's all this talk about going to Mars or maybe the dark side of the moon and settling there and establishing human colonies, as if these people never read the Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury. And so the question is, why don't we adopt those technologies and employ them here now that we have created a basically inhospitable planet? I don't know of anything. I don't know of anybody who's planning to terraform Earth. It looks like we've already done that for a long time. We've been doing for a long time, we've been terraforming, and it hasn't quite worked out the way we had in mind. Mistakes have been made. Seemed like a good idea at the time. All those things apply. I don't know what could be done at this point. Civilization is a heat engine. Turning off the heat engine warms it faster. Civilized approaches to dealing with a problem rooted in civilization seem a little optimistic to me. I'm not suggesting inaction. I don't know at the scale of society what those actions are that would matter. I haven't seen them laid out. I haven't seen anything reasonable that would lead to a cooling of the planet in the necessary time frame. And yet, I'm all in favor of big ideas and implementing ideas, but because we're talking here about the extinction of our favorite species, I'm not a fan. I'm looking for rational approaches.
Can you explain why there's a 30-year time lag between the emission of the CO2 or the CO2 atmosphere and the effect that's experienced as radiative force?
Yeah, you know, there's a paper published at the website Skeptical Science that indicated about a 40-year lag between emission of the carbon dioxide molecule and maximum heating associated with that molecule. The heating begins immediately. And as soon as the carbon dioxide enters the atmosphere, there is some heating. A more recent analysis in the Refereed Journal literature indicates a 10-year lag. In Environmental Research Letters from December 2014, indicates a 10-year lag. Actually, I think it's 9.9, plus or minus. I don't remember the numbers, the standard deviations on the numbers. So roughly a 10-year lag between emission and maximum heating associated with those molecules. And that's because CO2 is busy. A whole bunch of it goes into the ocean first. So it doesn't produce much heating there. So on average, a certain number of molecules go into the ocean and a few go into the atmosphere directly. So on average, the sort of typical molecule ends up providing maximum heating after it spends some time wandering around in the ocean, swimming around with the fish, and then popping back out and going into the atmosphere. So that's why the lag, as I understand it. I'll bet a decent explanation is provided in the abstract of that paper, better than something I could come up with. It's a good question. And it's something that was poorly understood, and thus the 40-year lag proposed in Skeptical Science and subsequently eclipsed by this more recent paper in Environmental Research Letters.
Sam Crater regularly posts data generated by the satellites, which haven't been available for all that long, that show increasing methane levels at altitude of 20,000, 30,000 feet. Can you comment on that?
Not intelligently, so I won't. And that's rare. You don't know how lucky you are. No, I really don't know enough about atmospheric methane and its action, its movement in the atmosphere. So
it seems to me one of the problems that is holding back and straining
something being done to cool the planet, Western religions, all of whom believe, fundamentalists do anyway, they believe in a deity that can end life on this planet or can completely create it. And a lot of these people are in control now in the United States. And as long as somebody believes that this is in God's hands, it seems like you'd have a real problem if something could be done. What are your thoughts about the fundamentalist religions and their attitude to God?
You know, people used to ask me simpler questions. And I like those people. Simple questions like, are you religious? Are you an atheist? Are you a believer? And I would say that no matter how I answer that question, it's going to provide a source of division. So I won't answer that question, because there are plenty of things to divide us and not nearly enough to keep us together. I believe that the Western religions arose approximately coincident with civilizations, the first civilizations, and so are emblematic of the patriarchy associated with civilizations. So to that extent, I think they're part of the history by which we arrived at this horrible point. And that'll be enough. Thank you.